It is Monday, June 8th. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Turkey's election.
The turnout is quite high in that region. Even some injured people from that rally, they just left hospital in their casts, in wheelchairs. They just went to the polling centers, cast their ballots, and they just went back to the hospital.
We'll go to Turkey for the latest, plus the Ukraine crisis on the G7 agenda, and a triple crown winner, finally. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Group of seven leaders have been meeting in Germany, where the main agenda for these G7 gatherings is usually trade, and it's often put aside in favor of more pressing issues. And as was expected, the leaders turned their attention this time to the Ukraine crisis and Russia's involvement. For some perspective on what's happening, VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with John Besmers. He's adjunct fellow, National Europe Center at the Australian National University.
A group of seven leaders vowed on Sunday in the Bavarian Alps to keep sanctions against Russia in place until President Putin and Moscow-backed separatists fully implement the terms of the Minsk ceasefire agreement for Ukraine. How likely is that to happen?
Not likely on present indications, but I think it's good that this is being resoundingly stated from the forum of the G7. There are, of course, quite a number of potential backsliders in the European Union, and the question of sanctions comes up very soon for reconsideration. Until now, it seemed likely, and I think it is still very likely, that they will be rolled over for another 6 months. But there have been quite a lot of signs of wavering within the EU, and that's not it encourages Putin, it undermines Ukraine, and it raises lots of doubts in people's minds. So I think a very forthright statement, as we've seen from the G7, is very useful in that context.
Well, what sanctions are in place and how could they tighten them?
Well, the sanctions that have counted for most, I think, have been the sanctions restricting Russian access to Western credit arrangements. And this, together with the sharp downturn in the Russian economy that was caused by the slump in the price of oil and associated with that, the slump in the price of gas also, of course, that this has, and the slump in the Russian ruble. All of those things at the end of last year dealt a very severe blow to the Russian economy, and that blow is continuing to be felt. There has been a partial recovery in those key prices, but it has continued to be felt, and that's what is giving the sanctions a good deal of force, I think. Many of the sanctions that have been implemented on both sides of the Atlantic haven't been particularly forceful, but those ones, I think in particular, the limited access for Russia to Western credit arrangements, that's going to be a continuing burden on their economy. And voices can be heard in Russia calling for efforts to somehow get the sanctions burden off their backs. So I think sanctions are working, but largely because of the accidental, in a sense, factor of the collapse in oil and gas prices. And without that, I don't think the sanctions would have had as much effect as they have had. But, of course, it is also the case that sanctions are not preventing the so-called separatists, the pro-Russians from, pro-Russian proxies, I think is the best word for them, has not prevented the Russians from continuing to probe Ukrainian defenses. And there's been a particularly bad example of that quite recently in the village of Marinka, which was the subject of what looked like a strategic attack just a few days ago. And I think that's that attack has probably given a bit of force to the discussions at the G7. But I think the sanctions could be tightened further, and I think the sanctions also need to be supported by by a more active U.S. presence in this whole issue, because Russia has been getting away with a great deal of nuclear intimidation and other forms of military intimidation and military action against its neighbors. And if the United States is not present in those so-called Normandy format negotiations, present and forcefully present, then Russia will try to get away with more than it should be allowed to get away with. So I think the G7 coming at this moment was also good in that it obviously involved the United States. And we've recently seen some very forceful statements also from Defense Secretary Carter, which I think have also been welcome. So I think it's a bit some more sanctions. There are sometimes it's referred to as the nuclear weapon in sanctions, to take Russia off the SWIFT system, as was done with Iran at a certain time. Now, I think it's possibly better just to keep that one hanging over their heads, but it should be hanging credibly over their heads. They should be worried about that, and I doubt that they're sufficiently worried at the moment.
Well, Professor, thanks again, sir. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
That's John Besmer, an adjunct fellow, National Europe Center at the Australian National University, speaking with my colleague, Victor Beatty. International Edition. Also in the news, and a stunning rebuke of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's ambitions to expand his powers. Voters in Turkey have stripped Mr. Erdogan's party of its simple majority in parliament. With 99.9% of the vote counted, Mr. Erdogan's ruling Justice and Development Party, the AKP, had the support of around 41% of voters, according to the state-run TRT television. And according to projections, that would give AKP 258 seats, which is 18 below the minimum needed to keep its majority.
AK Parti bu seçimin galibidir ve birincisidir.
The result is also a bitter blow to Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu, whose political prospects are uncertain after leading his party to such a disappointing result. However, Mr. Davutoğlu told crowds the AKP had won the election. AKP will now have to seek a coalition partner to stay in power, and likely will be the nationalist MHP as the candidate to join them. For the first time, the People's Democratic Party, the HDP, cleared the 10% vote count threshold that's needed to join parliament, with some analysts predicting it would seat nearly 75 lawmakers. My colleague Michael Lippin spoke with Alp Esmer of the VOA Turkish service about the HDP.
In the past, that party used to run their independent candidates into the parliament, so that's how they managed to get into the parliament. But it's the first time they're entering the race as a party in whole, not as independent candidates.
Regarding that party, the HDP, which has a strong base of support in the Kurdish part of Turkey, which is mostly in the east, do we have any idea what the turnout was like there? I mean, there was some violence. There was a bomb attack just a few days ago. But did people still turn out in big numbers in those Kurdish-dominated regions?
It is true, though. I mean, I was there in Diyarbakir during the explosion. I was actually watching that rally, and I heard two explosions, and there were a lot of wounded people, and two people died there, and it was quite sad. All political leaders expressed their condolences. And on the other hand, psychologically, such attacks, such incidents would just help the party to rally more support in its own favor. The turnout is quite high in that region. And I just heard in the news, even some injured people from that rally, they just left hospital in their casts in wheelchairs. They just went to the polling centers, cast their ballots, and they just went back to the hospital.
Alp Esmer of the VOA Turkish service speaking from Turkey. Still ahead, the plight of migrants crossing the Mediterranean. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
International Flotilla rescued nearly 6,000 migrants from rickety boats in the Mediterranean over the weekend, with the total number of mostly Middle Eastern and African migrants seeking a better life in Europe approaching 50,000 so far this year. The tide of migrants escaping poverty, persecution, and conflict taking the dangerous sea journey is on the rise. More than 1,800 have perished in that attempt. After 800 migrants died in one incident in April, the European Union embarked on a more aggressive rescue effort. EU plans to meet next week on how to disperse the migrants, now mostly on Italian territory. Foreign ministers of Egypt, Algeria, and Italy met in Cairo Sunday and called for peaceful political solution in the North African country.
تطابقت وجهات النظر بين بلداننا في ثلاث محاور.
Algerian Foreign Minister Abdelkader Massaoul says all three agreed to three main points: a need for a political solution and the formation of a national government to fix the Libyan situation. The second related to security issues, especially fighting terrorism, and third, solving the problem of illegal migration. Libya is divided between rival governments and militia groups, while militants of the Islamic State group have established a foothold in the country. UN is trying to broker a national unity government. In Libya on Sunday, IS militants killed three soldiers loyal to the Islamist-dominated government in Tripoli. They stormed a military police checkpoint east of Misrata. Nigeria's former president, Goodluck Jonathan, made history by conceding defeat and handing power to his opponent back in the March presidential election. Now that he has left office, analysts say Mr. Jonathan likely will not live much of a public life, at least not in Nigeria. Hours after the inauguration ceremony last week for the new Nigerian president, Muhammadu Buhari, Mr. Jonathan was back in Yanagoa, the capital of his home state of Bayelsa, which he governed before ascending to the vice presidency and then the presidency itself. We got more now from Chris Stein.
At 57 years old, Mr. Jonathan's future remains unclear. In a speech to supporters welcoming him home, he spoke of handing the reins to others who could build up Nigeria.
I remain most grateful for all Nigerians. The best I can do now is to dedicate the remaining part of my life to peace building across the country.
This year's election was essentially a rematch of the 2011 vote. Around 800 people died in the days after that election, as Mr. Buhari disputed his loss to Mr. Jonathan. In the run-up to the March polls, civil society groups had warned violence could happen again. But this time, Mr. Jonathan called Mr. Buhari and conceded defeat even before the final result was announced. Mr. Jonathan's grace after losing has prompted commentators to speculate that the international community would reward him somehow. Perhaps he would be a United Nations peace envoy, or be given a similar title by the African Union or West African Regional Bloc, ECOWAS. Emmanuel Onwubiko, a retired journalist and head of the Human Rights Writers Association of Nigeria, says Mr. Jonathan likely will not lead much of a public life in Nigeria. His future lies abroad, he says. Local media reported that Mr. Jonathan turned down a position on the board of trustees of his party, the People's Democratic Party, or PDP. Until Mr. Jonathan's loss, the party had held office in Nigeria since the country returned to democracy in 1999. As it transitions into being an opposition party for the first time in its history, former PDP party treasurer Bala Kaoje says the party will look to move beyond Mr. Jonathan. One thing is for sure, Onwubiko says, Mr. Jonathan will be nothing like his sole living predecessor, former President Olusegun Obasanjo. Mr. Obasanjo was a thorn in Mr. Jonathan's side during his term. Weeks before the election, he publicly renounced his membership in the PDP, a move that some analysts say contributed to Mr. Jonathan's defeat. Chris Stein for VOA News, Dakar.
World Economic Forum on Africa took place in Cape Town, South Africa in recent days. This year's forum focused on finding ways to ensure the continent's economic growth helps not only investors and business owners, but ordinary Africans as well. VOA's Anita Powell reporting now from Johannesburg.
For centuries, the African continent has been seen as an economic battlefield for its rich natural resources. But officials, investors, and business leaders have tried for 25 years to change that mindset at the annual World Economic Forum on Africa. Now the WEF is focused on another goal, making sure that Africa's economic growth impacts hundreds of millions of Africans who struggle to survive in chronic, grinding poverty. Business and government officials from the world's largest economy, the United States, say this year's conference, held this week in Cape Town, has seen a growing awareness of the need for stable and sustainable growth that helps ordinary people as well as investors. Elizabeth Littlefield is president and CEO of the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, a U.S. government organization that provides financing for private sector projects. It focuses on initiatives that will lead to greater growth and development, like renewable energy, solar and wind power facilities, and natural gas projects.
We're seeing more and more interest. And one challenge, one of the many challenges, but I would say one that we see on the horizon that I'm quite interested in, is how do we make sure that economic growth, which is so powerful in so much of the continent, benefits all of Africans, lifts up livelihoods and improves lives of ordinary Africans as well.
But, says U.S. Trade and Development Agency Director Leocadia Zak, major challenges remain. One is the continent's dire lack of good roads, electrical grids, and other structures needed for strong economic growth. The World Bank estimates that Africa needs investments of at least $93 billion a year to fix these problems.
One of the things that we have heard consistently throughout the past couple of days is that one of the biggest constraints to economic growth on the continent is the lack of infrastructure and the need for infrastructure. And what we've also heard is that one of the constraints to the development of that infrastructure are well-prepared projects.
Infrastructure development can be a tough sell for the profit-hungry investor crowd, as it takes time and massive resources. But Daniela Baluarez, the State Department's Senior Advisor for Development, says she is pleased to hear investors say they are more interested than ever in development projects.
At World Economic Forum in Africa, we've seen that the business community wants to be a part of this as well. We're hearing both businesses and governments speaking about the importance of inclusive growth, the role that the private investment can play in addressing energy challenges, agricultural challenges, the opportunity to increase the role of women in the economy and the benefits for growth that has.
The conference ends Friday. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Sports history was made Saturday on the horse track as 3-year-old American Pharoah crossed the finish line ahead of its challengers in the Belmont Stakes in New York, just as he did in the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness. American Pharoah is only the 12th horse to win all three races, which is known as the Triple Crown, since Sir Barton first did it in 1919. This win was made more special by the longest ever gap between Triple Crown winners. It's 37 years since a firm won it back in 1978. USA Today sports columnist Christine Brennan was among the thousands at Belmont Park to witness the race, and my colleague Jim Stevenson spoke with her.
It was great, Jim, and no, they have not. It was terrific. It was one of the great sporting events I have ever covered. I've been doing this more than 30 years, and I've covered 16 Olympics in a row, and I consider myself so fortunate and lucky to be able to do any of these things. But this was right up there, and I think it was just so majestic. And the way he won, American Pharoah, with that amazing kick in the back stretch again, and then coming down the stretch with knowing he was going to win it, the whole world knowing he was going to win it, finally a Triple Crown after 37 years. It doesn't get much better than that.
And with Victor Espinoza on board, his third crack at it.
That's right. The jockey was trying for his third time to win a Triple Crown. And, of course, the trainer, Bob Baffert, this was his fourth try after winning the first two legs with three other horses before American Pharoah. So, in many ways, this was much more a horse racing establishment than other years when there have been kind of these quirky owners and these rags-to-riches stories. This is more of the establishment with Espinoza, with Baffert, and, of course, the owner, Ahmed Zayed, who is controversial but has been around a long time as well. People were saying, well, this isn't that exciting because they're not the characters that some of these other people have been. That is true. But maybe it took a much more establishment-style horse to actually do it.
We've both been to the Belmont several times in the quest for this to finally happen, and so many disappointments. The crowd, though, I understand, was just unbelievable after American Pharoah crossed the line.
Well, it was 37 years of screaming, I think, that was coming out of everyone. It was an extraordinary roar that went on for minutes, and it was the cheering, the leaping for joy. I have a couple pictures that I put on Twitter and Facebook that just show everyone raising their arms. A spectacular release of energy and excitement as American Pharoah came down the stretch. It was one of the things I will remember for a long, long time, and I haven't seen many things like it in my career, and that includes a lot of great events.
Because we didn't know when this would happen, and because it has taken so long to happen, that has probably magnified the achievement of American Pharoah. I guess it has really boosted horse racing, a much-needed boost.
I think it has, although I'm not sure how much of a shelf life there will be and what will happen next. I don't see people racing out to horse tracks. We'll see him race once or twice more, and then he will go and do what horses do and retire. And so, yes and no. I don't see there being a big carryover. It reminds me a little of all the talk after the 1980 Olympic hockey triumph, the miracle on ice by the U.S. over the Soviets, and then winning the gold 2 days later. That, oh, this will change hockey, everyone will play hockey. No, that did not happen, but that's okay, because it's only the greatest sports upset in history. I feel the same way here, and it's over, and that's okay, too. It doesn't have to be anything more than it is, because what it is was fantastic, and I think that's a big, big thing to take away from this.
Well, you mentioned tweeting some of the photos you had taken, and one of the photos I saw you took very late at the track. It was dark. It was quiet. It's a scene that those of us who have covered the event have witnessed, because we have to work long hours there, long past the crowd's departure. It was a very surreal photo of the track.
Well, oh, thanks. Yeah, I was walking out with my colleague Dan Wolkin, one of the other writer for USA Today, who was covering the race, and we were going to his car and had to drive back to our respective hotels. So as we're walking around the track, I just looked out, and that's the stretch. And so I thought, wow, what a moment. Just a few hours ago, the whole world was focused on this area, and now it's dark, and no one's there, and it's silent, and it was perfect. And so that's why I took that picture.
Capturing all the great sports moments, Christine Brennan, USA Today sports columnist, thank you so much. And if you're not following her on Twitter, my gosh, what are you waiting for? At C. Brennan Sports. Thank you, Chris.
Oh, my gosh. Thanks so much.
And thank you, Jim. VOA's Jim Stevenson there. You should check out her Twitter site. Now it's time for a little music talk with VOA's David Byrd.
One of the hot concert tickets this year in the United States is the Zip Code Tour by the Rolling Stones. Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, Ron Wood, and Charlie Watts are rocking stadiums all over the United States. One person you have heard but might not know his name is saxophonist Tim Reese. Eric Felton joins me in the studio to talk about Tim's career and his influence on some very powerful names in rock and roll. Eric, welcome.
Welcome, Dave. How are you doing?
I'm good. Now, obviously, when people go to see a Stones show, they go to see the Stones, but this guy, Tim Reese, has got some mad saxophone skills, and he's also collaborated, I think you told me, with Charlie Watts, the drummer from the Stones, on some jazz pieces, too, right?
Yes, Tim Reese is this fabulous jazz saxophonist who has also made a name for himself in the pop world as a sideman, playing with some of the great pop bands. He's played with Lyle Lovett, played with Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and he's toured now for well over a decade with the Rolling Stones as a saxophone player, and also plays keyboards, including Hammond B3 organ for the Stones when they're on tour. But the great thing about having a jazz player as part of your band is you may be doing big stadium tour, and the Stones this week were in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota, and they were on a Wednesday night doing their big stadium tour, and Tim Reese on Tuesday night, the night before, had booked himself a little date at the Dakota, which is a little jazz club in Minneapolis. And so he's playing some Rolling Stones songs there, and who should be at the club, at the bar, and come and sit in with the band but Charlie Watts, the drummer of the Rolling Stones, and then a couple of the other sidemen from the Stones. So in a way, you got a little taste of the big stadium concert at a little jazz club the night before the stadium concert. And I'm going to be interested to see if this happens more often throughout the rest of this tour. If you're in a city where the Stones are coming to play, you might be on a lookout for what's happening at the jazz clubs around the time.
Now, he also has covered some Stones tunes as well, right? He's got his own recordings of some of their hits like Satisfaction and Honky Tonk Women and some of the others, right?
Yeah, he's done two records, the first called The Rolling Stone Project and then the second called Stones World, The Rolling Stones Project 2. The first of those came out in 2005, the second one in 2008, and he's put out a bunch of jazz records, Tim Reese has, but the Rolling Stones project records were all Stones music that he then gave jazz interpretations to, and he's managed to get some of the best artists in the world of jazz to be part of those recordings, as well as the Rolling Stones themselves. So he managed on those records to mix in Keith Richards, Ron Wood, Charlie Watts, with Norah Jones, John Scofield, Bill Frisell, great, great jazz musicians, and the results are really remarkable.
Now, are we gonna see him on Beyond Category, maybe? We're going to try to get him on your show?
I hope so. I hope if he comes through Washington, D.C., we'll see if we can get him to do the show.
All right. Thanks a lot, Eric. Eric is the host of VOA's Beyond Category. You can see that on our website, www.voanews.com. And, Eric, do you have a Twitter handle where people can reach you?
We have the Twitter VOA Music handle where we hope people will come and keep up with what we're doing.
So that's at VOA Music?
Yes.
All right. Thanks a lot, Eric. We'll see you next time.
Nice stuff, huh? Ronnie Gilbert, the female voice who gave balance to the famous folk quartet The Weavers, has died at age 88.
There is a house in New Orleans, they call the rising sun. It has been the ruin of many a poor girl.
Very nice. Ronnie Gilbert singing The House of the Rising Sun. On the guitar there, Fred Hellerman and Eric Darling. Weavers, whose most famous member might have been Pete Seeger, got together in the 1940s, laid the groundwork for the big folk festival revival of the 1950s and the 1960s. Gilbert said in a documentary, "We sang those songs in hope after World War II. They sang for hope, about hope, loud as hope, strong for hope. They were happy people." Listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Zimbabwe, once a pride of Africa and its breadbasket, has fallen far in recent decades, driven down by government policies, political violence, and economic decline. The nation's leaders, after many years of confrontation, now seek to re-engage with the West, hoping to see an easing of targeted sanctions they blame for many of the country's problems. Some restrictions, in fact, have been removed by the European Union against some officials, and the possibility of financial aid has been discussed. The United States, however, believes that current circumstances in the troubled Southern African nation do not merit a change in our policies there, though we remain hopeful that in the future they will. Last month, two top U.S. diplomats, Deputy Assistant Secretaries of State Shannon Smith and Stephen Feldstein, spent 4 days in Zimbabwe assessing conditions there with government leaders, U.S. Embassy staff, opposition lawmakers, and civil society. In the meetings, they reaffirmed U.S. messages of support for the Zimbabwean people and communicated our nation's hopes for economic development and democratic reforms. They also pressed the case of human rights activist Itai Dzamara, who went missing on March 9th after having been forced into a car by five men. He hasn't been seen since. What they found was a fractured political system, an economy in desperate straits, and looming food insecurity caused by drought and harmful government agricultural policies. Against this backdrop, they reported at the time, and Mr. Smith repeated in a hearing before our Congress on June 2nd, that U.S. interests in Zimbabwe remain the same. Travel and financial sanctions imposed on government leaders and their supporters linked to political violence and human rights abuses will remain in place, while we continue to support and promote a peaceful, democratic, and prosperous Zimbabwe that provides for its people and contributes to regional stability. To realize these interests, we will remain engaged with both government and non-government leaders alike to work together in areas of common concern. In so doing, the United States remains the leading provider of humanitarian assistance to Zimbabwe in the form of food aid, HIV/AIDS prevention programs, democracy, humanitarian assistance, economic growth, agriculture, and health infrastructure support. Our assistance has saved countless lives, is strengthening civil society, and is laying the groundwork for a brighter future for the Zimbabwean people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.